Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
At Alma, we know the connection between you and your therapist matters. But if you're already feeling stressed and burnt out, the idea of trying to find a therapist you really connect with can be overwhelming. That's why Alma's focused on helping you find the right therapist for you. When you browse their online directory, you can filter by the qualities that are most important to you. Then, book free 15-minute consultations with any therapist you're interested in seeing. And because 95% of therapists at Alma accept insurance, you can find care that's affordable too. You want to talk to someone, but not just anyone. Alma is there to help you find the right fit. Visit helloalma.com/therapy30 to schedule a free consultation today. That's helloalma.com/therapy30.
The Jericho Network on Westwood One. All right, this is Chris Jericho, and thank you for downloading Talk is Jericho today. My good friend Annie Bierzak from Black Veil Brides is here. The new record is called Black Veil Brides. It's their fourth record out now. And the Black Mass Tour with Memphis Mayfire and Ghost Town starts tomorrow in Richmond, Virginia. Lots of great stuff from my good friend Andy today. He started Black Veil Brides. We'll talk about that. The music video he made for like $150 that went to viral to about 50 million views plus so far. The F-bomb incident at the Golden Gods Awards, the time he fell off a balcony while trying to rock and roll, so many great stories.
The following program is a PodcastOne.com production.
He's a world champion wrestler,
best-selling author,
actor,
and lead singer of Fozzy.
Now
he's rocking the podcast world.
Yay!
This is Talk is Jericho.
Talk is Jericho.
Starring Chris Jericho.
Welcome to Talk is Jericho, the pot of thunder and rock and roll. The spell you're under has been broken by Chris Jericho. The People's Podcast has arrived. The remedy for boredom is here. Let's go for a ride. right, it's a little spider in my mouth from Fozzy, the Cinnabones record. Going back a little bit, going back a few years, I wanted to play some heavy kick-ass rock and roll for my heavy kick-ass rock and roll guest today, Andy Bierzak from Black Veil Brides. Very, very good friend of mine. We always have a blast. He's got so many great stories to tell. How he moved to L.A. with nothing, lived in his car on the Sunset Strip. Wait till you find out who the first person he met was, his first rock and roll friend. He managed to shoot a music video for no money, and he didn't have a band, and how that video went viral to the tune of like 55 million views so far. That's for the song Knives and Pens. We'll get a blow-by-blow account of that, and a blow-by-blow account of one of the worst injuries he's ever suffered on stage when he fell off a balcony, all in the name of rock and roll. Plus, he'll take us through the infamous F-bomb experience at the Golden Gods Award show. Shut up, fat boy! Went a little Ric Flair when he went nuts on the fans at the Golden Gods. It's when I got all respect for Mr. Andy Bierzak. Plus, he's a huge Kiss fan. He's a huge Paul Stanley fan and a very talented guy as well. Andy Bierzak from the Black Veil Brides is on the way. But first, as a friendly reminder, have you nominated Talk is Jericho for a 2015 podcast award yet, huh? If you love this show half as much as I love doing it, then you should definitely hit up podcastawards.com and nominate it. It'd be very, very fruit to win a podcast award. Just finished out my first year here on Talk is Jericho. So give me some awards, man. Help me become a winner. I want to be a winner. They'll be handed out in April in Las Vegas at the New Media Expo. So if you want to show a little love to Talk is Jericho, just go to podcastawards.com and fill out the nomination form. I got to be nominated first before I can win. You got to add the show's URL link in the form. And the easiest way to do that is to go to podcastone.com, click on Talk is Jericho, then copy the show page link and paste it into the form. Nominations close next Friday. Go to podcastawards.com, give your favorite podcast, which of course is Talk is Jericho, nominate it in the sports category, in the entertainment category, in the sexy beast category, whatever category it is. Get doing it, man. I want to say thanks to my sponsors as well of Talk is Jericho, the ones who let me do this for you for free for twice a week. Thanks to all of you as well for supporting all my amazing partners here: Dollar Shave Club, Smart Mouth, DDP Yoga, Nature Box, Arctic Ease, Me Undies, Amazon. So many great people aboard already. And Amazon, huge proud sponsor of Talk is Jericho. Thanks to you guys for doing your online shopping through my Amazon links. Easiest way to support the show: you go to podcastone.com, click on the Keep Our Podcast Free banner at the top of the page. Hey, hit Talk is Jericho button. Every time you use one of my Amazon links, Amazon kicks back a couple bucks to the show. Help us cover production costs. You know I got links for the USA, in the UK, in the Canada, all across North America, over the pond. And you can get whatever you want on Amazon. You can still get CDs, MP3s there. Get the new Black Veil Brides self-titled record produced by Bob Rock. Very, very cool. Get all Black Veil Brides records. Get Do You Want to Start a War, the new Fozzy record. Get The Best in the World at What I Have No Idea, the new Christian Jericho New York Times best-selling novel. Whatever you want, go get it. The truth about my links is you buy whatever you want, no hidden fees, extra charges. So if you're doing some online shopping, do it through the Amazon links. Help me out. Go to podcastone.com, click on the Keep Our Podcast Free banner at the top of the page, then hit the Talk is Jericho button, bookmark it as well, so you can get to those links in one easy click. All right, had a great time this weekend after WWE and during WWE Calgary and Edmonton. It's always fun for me to go and do that loop, especially now that there's no TVs. It's just live events. And as you know, I'm just doing live events for January and February. It's already February. I got, I think, 10 of those events already in the books, or 9 already in the books. Only got a few left. It's Jacksonville, Canton, Ohio, Tampa, Fort Myers, Madison Square Garden, Toronto, Buffalo. So they're winding down already. We're already on the back end of it. But, man, I had a great time this weekend in Calgary and Edmonton. I got in on Friday night, went over to my wise cousin Chad's house. And he's a real vinyl phobe. He loves LPs. So we just listened to albums all night. We listened to Streetheart and Loverboy and put on some Black Sabbath, Speak of the Devil. It's actually the Aussie Speak of the Devil, where he does nothing but Black Sabbath songs. Had a great conversation with Rudy Sarzo, who played bass while we were listening to that, which is always cool. Also had a conversation with Paul Stanley about cooking. He was telling me all about his upcoming cooking and recipes, and we're talking about chicken, how he cooks his chicken, how I cook my chicken. This is how I cook my chicken, people! But yeah, it's pretty funny when you're having a conversation with Paul Stanley and then also Rudy Sarza while you're listening to Speak of the Devil. And Speak of the Devil, if you haven't seen the Quiet Riot documentary, well, now you're here. There's no way back. It was on Showtime a couple days ago. Amazing documentary about the rise and fall of a very underrated band in Quiet Riot. If you listen to the Metal Health album, and that is a great, great album. So if you get a chance to check out that documentary, Rudy Sarza is in it. Go watch it. So we did that, me and Wise Cousin Chad and Speedway. Of course, just drinking, yeah, boys, and just starting to go nuts and filming stupid videos. And, you know, we were going to do a podcast, but we got too drunk, so we didn't really have time to do it. And, you know, then Speedway leaves, and I pass out for a few hours. Then I wake up. I got to drive to Edmonton, where I meet up with my cousin Todd and his family. They live there, so I had lunch with them. Then I went over to the venue, and I had a podcast interview with a multi-time world champion who you're going to love. I'm really excited I got him. He's been on my wish list for a while. Then did the show in Edmonton, worked with Cesaro again. And some nights, you know, every show you do, you strive for it to be amazing. And some nights they are, some nights they aren't, some nights they're okay. But you get certain nights that are just like those perfect, all the fruit line up, and you leave the ring just going, oh my gosh, that was so amazing. Not just the match, but the crowd, the atmospheres, the reactions, everything. And that's what it was like in Edmonton on Saturday night. It was such an amazing night, and it was a lot of fun. So cool to have my cousin Todd there checking it out. Then I went over to YEG Dance Club right across from the Rexall Place Arena. I was invited there, taken care of by some very nice people, AJ over there and a couple other cats. Basically just to go hang out, have a couple drinky winkies, and sit around and get paid. So it's always cool to do that. And I got to hang out with my buddy David Benoit, and always cool to see him. He's doing good. He's a good kid. So we had fun, and it was funny because I went to the hotel first to drop off my car. David and I drove over there, and I said to the guys, listen, can you send someone to come pick me up, because I don't want to drive home from the club, you know? And they're like, oh, we'll send a limo for you. I'm like, ooh, aren't I fancy? They sent a limo bus, a party bus, and it was just me and David. And the guy's like, I thought you would have a whole entourage. It's like, no, I don't have an entourage. I just have my friend. So me and Dave sat in the back of the party bus, you know, sits like 40 people, just me and him in the back with the stripper pole, just hanging around. So I had a great time at that. Stayed up way too late once again. Had to get up early to drive to Calgary because it was an early show, 1 o'clock show. Got a chance to run into Lance Storm there, and Bret Hart was at the show. Why they didn't put Bret on the show, even because it drives me nuts. It's so stupid that they have Bret Hart, one of the best of all time, sitting backstage, but they don't have anything for him to do on the show in Calgary. But whatever, none of my business. That show was kind of the exact opposite of the Edmonton show. It was very quiet. The crowd was a little more subdued. But it happens sometimes. We still wrestle hard and still had a cool match. And Cesaro is a great, great performer. I'm having a lot of fun working with him, helping him work on his promos and just rocking it. After that, I saw my friend Ajax and his family. Chad came again, Wise Cousin Chad. Spew was there. Lon, who's a good friend of ours, he had a lot to do with the boots story, if you heard that a couple weeks ago. So then we drove up to Banff. And as we drove up to Banff, listened to my friend Chris Hardwick's podcast, The Nerdist, with Martin Short and Paul McCartney, which was great. We get to Banff. We stay at the amazing Fox Hotel, thanks to the fine people there. Went to the room, just started drinking again, then went to the Keg, which is a great restaurant, had a great meal, and just having so much fun. Like, you get certain guys together. I mean, you guys have heard Speewee and Wise Cousin Chad and Lon, and we're just laughing our heads off. And, you know, we all have solo cups, and everyone has to write a funny name on it. So my funny name was Gitchington. Chad was C. Hadley Watkins, which was the actor name I gave him years ago when we were kids. He wanted to be an actor. So we can't be Chad Holowaddick. You need a show business name. So he was C. Hadley Watkins. Lon was Scatman. We're not sure why. And Speewee was Bukowski, because he's been going through this Bukowski phase where he's very pretentious and tells all the girls that he likes that he's into Bukowski. Then we went into the Grotto hot tub and just hung out there for a while. And I had gotten this really disgusting picture from a friend of mine and sent it over to Speewee, and he sent it to, I don't know who he's trying to send it to, but he ended up sending it to this girl he's been dating, and it was really bad. And he's like, no, I didn't do it. Lon did it. And super, super embarrassed. And this picture, guys, was one of the grossest pictures I've ever seen in my life. So that's how Speewee picks up the chicks. I think he was able to talk himself out of it, but he hasn't seen her since, so we'll see what happens. And then after rocking it all night, we got up early, and well, not too early. We hit the hill by about 11 o'clock and went snowboarding all day in sunshine up in Banff. It was beautiful weather, minus one, just ripping it up on the snowboard, and I didn't wipe out once. And, man, nothing better than being on the hill. Just had a great time. Then went to the Calgary Flames, won a big Jets game last night with Ajax and Chad and Speewee and Lon and Hippie Ray and Al Kinnear and all the boys. And it didn't work out too well for the Jets. They lost 5-2. But anyways, point being, it was a great weekend. I had an amazing time. Always a blast to go back to Calgary and Edmonton. Always a blast to be around friends and get a chance to do a couple shows in the area where I grew up. So I thank you, Mother Calgary. I thank you, Edmonton. We will see you again soon. I guarantee it. And we're going to be seeing Andy Biersack from Blackville Brides very soon.
Talk is Jericho.
All right, yeah. Here with my good friend, Andy Biersack. Is it Biersack or Biersack? How do you pronounce it?
I think it's Biersack because that's how we pronounce it in my family. But it was one of those things where I've been told that the correct pronunciation is something else. But okay. I guess we just chose Biersack, which is possibly the ugliest way you could say it. Biersack or something has a much
Biersack.
More... Yeah, I think maybe it's just a little bit too Germanic. I don't know.
Yeah. Did people bug you when you were in high school at Biersack?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
More often than not, I was referred to as Ballsack, which is, you know...
Of course. Yeah.
It's a wonderful nickname for a child.
Yeah, exactly.
I never cursed my parents for having that last name.
I like the Biersack.
Yeah, it sounds aggressive.
Like a German death metal band.
Yeah.
Biersack.
That's why I like that band, the Japanese punk band Balzac. I thought I had a kindred spirit just with the name. Perfect.
You have to guest on them.
Yeah.
You have to do like one of those 7-inch singles for Record Store Day.
Yeah.
Biersack versus Balzac.
Yeah, Biersack and Balzac. Attack of the Sack.
Put that on the marquee.
Yeah.
Now you were saying, you texted me earlier and you said that you were down in the parking garage hanging out and you were early, which is very rare for a musician in LA, no less, too.
You say hanging out in the parking garage like I was having a party down there. It's usually...
Trying to pick up some tricks.
Yeah, it consists of... my manager told me early in my career that it's always best to be on time, which I think is probably true of anybody in any walk of life.
Of
but I took it very seriously, and so much so that I am exceptionally early to all things, or at least I try to be. Today I drove down here with way too much time. And then the thing is, like, you find yourself when you know you're too early not caring about little things that bother you when you're driving.
Yeah.
Like if somebody's driving slow or somebody's doing something stupid – for you, you're just killing time now. You might arrive closer to the actual time you're supposed to be there. So I'm just along for the ride.
Which is a good point, because if someone's like stopping at a yellow and you're in a rush, like, go, go,
yeah,
go.
See, it's taking the stress away.
I had that years ago. I sat on a plane from Calgary to LA with Owen Hart, the late, great Owen Hart. It was one of the only times I ever got a chance to really talk to him. And he was like, yeah, man, get to the airport like 20 minutes early. Have a coffee, relax. That way you'll never be stressed out.
Yeah.
And I still try and adhere to that.
Absolutely.
Like you said, a couple minutes early is always better.
I would love to say that I'm always with that with the airport, but the problem is that I am I'm the type of flyer that it's always an emergency. Like, I didn't know that I was about to leave on a flight. Like, I don't know what it is about me and planes, but when I go to pack, it's as if I did not know. Like, someone came to my house that morning and said, go, go, go.
What?
We have to leave.
What?
Yeah, I don't know why. I will know for weeks and months that I'm leaving for tour, and the night before, I'm like, oh, I forgot about laundry. And then, you know.
Do you pack at night and then get up and go, or do you get up earlier and pack and go?
Always pack at night.
Okay, see,
this is a wonderful conversation, by the way. We're talking about packing. This is the real rock and roll.
This is the real stuff. Yeah. See, no, to me, for me, I'm always too lazy at night. So I pack in the morning. I have to get up early. Like, if I have to leave at 6, I get up at 5.
Right.
But what if you sleep in? Then there's a problem.
There is a huge
problem.
That's the
issue. So you're smart.
Yeah, I'm not a morning person.
Mm-hmm.
So much so that I'm aggressive if people try to talk to me in the morning. Like, I have kind of a standing rule on the bus where even our assistant won't speak too much to me in the morning. Not to say that I'm some sort of like jerk, but I have this weird thing where I immediately, when I wake up, am angered that that happened to me. Like, how could you do this to me?
How dare you
wake
me up?
How could you wake me up? I was sleeping. How could you do this?
Especially on the bus when you're probably, like, waking up at, like, 2 in the afternoon
or
something.
Yeah, right? I can't believe it.
How dare you wake me up with the school kids coming home from school? But you're talking about being on the road, and it's actually the eve of the Black Mass Tour 2015, the second leg, or at least in the States, I believe it's the second leg. Yeah. Hugely successful. You guys are at a completely different level now with the new record with Blackville Brides 4. Are you happy so far with the reception and how the band has grown over the last year?
Absolutely. How can I not be?
Yeah.
It's one of those things where it's really hard to predict, or it's impossible, I think, to predict what's gonna work. And I think people tend to insult their audience's intelligence by saying, this is the thing that's going to propel us, or this is the thing that's going to work, because you don't know how people are going to react. Mm. And so you kind of do your best and you do something that you really love, and hope that people enjoy it. And so far we've had a great reaction to the record. We really enjoyed making it. The band is closer. I've told you the band's really close right now in a way that maybe we weren't in the last couple of 3 or 4 years.
Why is that?
I don't know. I think that when you first start a band, the necessity of being best friends is there because you're all on the pirate ship together. You're doing the same thing. Likely you're struggling to get by. You're making it from show to show. You're in a van or a car or an RV or whatever. And you need to have that level of camaraderie. And then once any form of success hits, things start to become more comfortable and people develop lives outside of the band, which is something that you couldn't possibly imagine when you first start a band, because you think that this is everything and I'm going to work towards it, and there's nothing else, and there's no home life, there's no houses, there's no mortgages, there's no cars.
Just on the road all the time.
Exactly. Yeah. And so what we faced was what most bands face, which is that not to say that we ever gave up on the dream or didn't want to keep going, but there's a certain level of like fat and comfortable that you get. And, people went through houses and marriages and everything else. And it's not to say that any of those things are negative or positive or whatever else. It's each their own in the band, and everybody should have their own personal life. But I think all of us got to the point where we were still putting the band first, but we had that reserve of like, when this tour is over, we're going to go home. And it's good to have that home life. But I think to a certain degree, it got to the point where we were separating ourselves as individual entities within the band. And we would go on tour and work towards the greater good on tour. And then when we got off tour, it was a see you later kind of thing.
Right.
With this record, we really, all of us wanted to make an effort to get back to the point where we felt like we were being back on that pirate ship and doing things as best friends and making sure that nothing happened. Sometimes it's hard for me to admit that I have a little bit of an ego, and
but you're a singer. Impossible.
Yeah, sure. And so I feel like in many ways I had to kind of be hyper conscious of the fact that I can kind of let things run away with my own whims and what I want to do, and not act in the responsibility of making sure that the rest of the band feels the same way. And so we set kind of a precedent with this record that everything was agreed upon five ways. Every song was done where all five of us are involved. Mm-hmm. Even if it's one or two people write the bulk of the song, making sure everybody has their voice heard and making sure that everybody's there. I mean, every step of the record, all five members were there. Mm-hmm. We had, even my drummer flew up when we did the vocals in Vancouver. Even my drummer was there every single day. He wasn't tracking a thing, but he came in just to listen to me track the vocals and to be there. And all of us were there for every single piece of the record. And I think that has kind of parlayed into the tour.
It's one of those things that you learn as you grow older and as you've spent time in a band together. Like a band is a great band is a great team. And like a sports team or a hockey team, football team, if you play your part within that team, you'll win. If you're a center iceman and you're trying to skate back and play goalie and then skate over here to be the right winger, and then it starts to fall apart, especially as singers and as creative people. I know I had that issue with Rich years ago where it's like, listen, you can't do everything. Right. You do what you do best. I'll do what I do best, and we'll do it for the greater good of the band. Right. Suddenly, the band starts to win.
Yeah, absolutely.
You got to let that control go a little bit sometimes.
Yeah, and it feels great. I mean, that's not to say that I don't have those moments of like, this is the thing and we're going to do this, but the great thing that I have is that I always feel a strong level of trust with the band. Mm-hmm. And the guys in the band always know that if I'm making a move that I feel is something that we should do, the conversation is never had from the place of like, oh, why do you think that? It's more of, you know, why is this the best move? How can we agree to this and kind of move forward from there? And so, I don't know, it's a really positive
vibe.
Well,
the original plan of the band was your vision, right? I mean, this is Black Veil Brides was started by you.
Yeah, I mean, the name, you know, yeah. I mean, we're going on nearly 10 years of that name mm-hmm. being a thing and having it be a project. What ultimately happened with me is that I started the band when I was so young, or started the concept of
yeah.
the band when I was so young, that it was very hard to find people that wanted to devote their lives in the same capacity. We're talking about a 16-year-old who's saying, hey, this is the thing that I'm going to do, and this is our whole life. And then a lot of times, especially where I grew up in Cincinnati, Ohio, a lot of the people that I grew up around had jobs and kids and, you know, that sort of thing where someone who is 21, 22 from a small town who has the capability to play bass or guitar or whatever in a band, the likelihood is that that's not their number one. Mm-hmm. Their onus on their life is not placed on being in a band. It's being
a kind of sacrifice yeah. for it. Yeah.
yeah. And so I wound up facing kind of the revolving door of band members for years until I relocated to Los Angeles. And then that's when I met the guys who have been in the band for the last 6 years.
Did you drive out here or take a bus, get your dad to drop you off?
No, I saved up my stake of $600, mm-hmm. which I quickly burned through.
In a day?
Yeah, and I came out here just basically with the idea that I was going to do it. And I dropped out of high school a few months before my graduation. Literally the day after I turned 18, I came out here. And I lived in my car. I had a black Cadillac Eldorado that I came out here with, and I lived in it. I've told the story before. I lived in the parking lot of
a
rehearsal space called ABC Studios in North Hollywood. No relation to the ABC. This was just ABC,
chain.
Like the beginning of the alphabet. Not, you know, nothing to do with the television. I lived in my car because one of the things that's great about a rehearsal space is that, especially lockouts, is they're 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So you can have their car, people can have their car there all day and night, and no one will get mad at you.
So you never had a space there. People would just assume it's somebody who's playing.
Well, we wound up working up to getting a space there. around a lot. I knew the rates.
Did anyone ever come out in the parking lot and like, hey,
sure,
you can't stay here.
Yeah, and the first person that came out in the parking lot just to say hello, because he was also living in his rehearsal space / his car, was Chris Holmes of Wasp.
Wow.
Fame. Yeah.
No
so
kidding.
That was my first friend in Los Angeles.
Now, Chris was the guitar player of Wasp and is nuts. Like, in a good way, maybe in a bad way sometimes. But
he's got an interesting disposition.
So he just came out to wonder, what's up, dude?
Yeah, and to show me his guitars that he had been building out of, like, tree trunks. And
he's the guy who goes, hey, dude, let's party in Blind in Texas. There you go.
Yeah, so we had a... He had a rehearsal space, which I guess he lived in. I went in there once, and it was sort of like, you know, like in a suspense thriller, there's like the room where the guy has been like really like ruminating on the guy he's trying to go after. And he's got sort of his career was like the thing that he had been.
Like all the pictures
on
the
wall.
Yeah,
there was pictures everywhere and like, you know, things that led to this and that. And he's telling the stories, and there was people sitting in there, and it was like a really wonderful crash course in like how rock and roll Los Angeles can be. And, you know, it was nice for me because as a kid, you come out and you think you have these kind of delusions of everything mm-hmm. is glitzy and wonderful. And then you're pretty much immediately met with kind of the parade of delusion that exists. And
the reality.
Yeah.
Of the
so I still got to kind of stray from the reality by living in my car next to Chris Holmes. It's like, there's still rock and roll is still alive.
When I was a kid, I remember seeing like if someone was on a record, especially if they had two records, I thought, oh, they're rich.
Yeah.
Like it's like if I saw someone on Stampede Wrestling, like Goldie Rogers,
sure.
Oh, he must be making $100,000 a year.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, he's making like $50 every second week. But you just thought like, he's in a band. He's got a record. They're huge.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's one thing that, I think it can be an issue, but I think that with a young kid, because they think that they're going to come out and then they're going to get a record deal and then it's going to be this big thing. But in some ways, I think it also it's important to cut your teeth.
Mm-hmm.
And I am thankful for the trials that I went
sure.
through to get to this point, because I feel like if I had been someone who came to L.A., met the right group of dudes, got a $1 million record contract, and everybody said, hey, kid, you're going to be a star – I think I wouldn't have had the respect level of like touring in a car
mm.
and being too tall for the car and having to put my feet out the window in the winter, which means wrapping up my feet with socks so they wouldn't freeze overnight. Like those experiences, when I look at us being in a bus with, you know, a truck full of gear and video screens on stage and all that stuff, it means more to me now. And if it crashes and burns tomorrow and people stop listening to Black Veil, it means that I had the opportunity to kind of have that trajectory and to learn something in my life.
It gives you, like you said, not just professional experience, but life experience, and it hardens you in a good way. Like, you're an old soul. You and I get along really well. We're really good friends, and there's quite an age difference between us, but I never notice it ever.
Sure.
You know, you definitely could tell that you have these experiences that have kind of pushed away a lot of the prima donna kind of temper tantrum type stuff that younger guys would have.
I've had my fair share of temper tantrums.
I have them all the time. But this is one of my favorite stories, and you told this when you were on my my radio show a couple years ago, but I want you to tell it to the audience here about the video Knives and Pens, which is, I think, at 52 million views on YouTube.
Sure. And if our previous label had not sold the rights to the video to a separate company, we would have had combined over about 150 million views.
Oh, it had to start over again?
Yeah, well, no, there's still the one that we uploaded, then there's the one that our ex-label put up under a different company, which also has about 56 million views. So,
there's about 150 million. That's got to be a record.
I don't know.
It's got to be up there.
I mean, when you got Psy out there, it's very hard. You know, it's hard for a little kid with swoopy bangs to keep up.
Whatever happened to old Psy? Poor guy.
Yeah, I don't know. He's dancing somewhere.
Gangnam Style.
Yeah, he's silent.
I knew he was done when I saw him in an animated movie about squirrels. That,
okay,
I took my kids to, and at the end he came out and danced with the squirrels. I'm like, he's done. We'll
that
never
is
see him
again. The death note, like,
it is.
For most people.
If there's
the
ever
swan song for a pop star
yeah,
is when you are an animated squirrel.
That's it. You're done. So this video is massively popular, and it's your first video, the first thing we'd ever seen from Black Veil Brides. Mm-hmm. And how did you put this together?
So I this is still within the time period where I was living in my car or bouncing around. And then I wound up getting in a relationship with a girl who was an actress at the time, and I'm still an actress. But
is that out here in LA?
Yes.
Okay.
And she's still an actress, but I'm saying at the time, mm-hmm, we were together. And it was one of those situations where, I don't know if you've ever seen, like, Forgetting Sarah Marshall, where, like, he has to hold the purse and,
yeah,
like, you know, that kind of thing. Which, you know, it was nothing against her or anything. It was just that I was a nobody in a nothing rock band at the time.
Sure.
Who, you know, was just a young kid who, you know, we had a positive relationship as much as you can when you're that age. I think, mm-hmm, I'm 17, 18 at the time. Or, yeah, I was 18, right, at the time. And it was just kind of one of those kind of, you know, tumultuous child relationships. But being that I had nothing and no money and no place to live, it allowed me the opportunity, and thank God to her for it. I had a couch to sit on. I,
right,
had a bed to sleep in. I had a way of kind of existing. And this is around the time when social media is kind of making its big push. You know, MySpace is kind of at its height.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have Twitter yet, but you have kind of the Facebook, MySpace kind of thing. And I had a great deal of time to sit on those things and kind of cultivate a network of people. Prior to moving to Los Angeles, I had a handful of songs that I had recorded in a basement in Northern Kentucky.
On a 4-track or something?
It was done on a very early computer. It was done on Logic, like the first version of Logic,
yeah.
With like MIDI drums and everything. Like, there's not, you know.
Did you play guitar on it?
I played bass on it somewhat, okay, because the guy who was in the band at the time got into a bar fight and broke his hand the night before we were supposed to record it. So,
of course.
So there was multiple instrumentation that was done in it by different people, but most of which was my best friend at the time, a guy named Chris Stewart, mm-hmm, who unfortunately, just because of circumstances in his life, he could not come out to L.A. with me. Mm-hmm. He was the person that I kind of banked he and I would go together.
Yeah.
He was, and still a great friend of mine, we're family friends and everything, great songwriter, mm-hmm, great musician. And so we wrote this song, Knives and Pens, together. And I had it, and I didn't really know what was going to happen with the band. At this point, now I'm in L.A., so I've spent a great deal of time kind of, you know, the Steven Tyler, like, fake it till you make it thing. I had told everyone who cared to listen that there was this wonderful, amazing band that existed, and I had these songs that I'd recorded. So up on MySpace, I had recorded songs, but there were no members. It was a band
of
one.
You,
it was
right?
Me. If I could do, like, you know, the old-timey multiple instrument thing with the, yeah, the drums and the everything. Yeah.
The cymbals on the knees.
Yeah. If I could have done that, I would have. But, you know, so I'm still on the search to find band members at this time, but I barely know anybody. The only community people that I really know are the people that I met at the rehearsal space,
Chris
and
Holmes,
now my girlfriend at the time's friend group.
Mm-hmm.
So those are kind of the only people that I know. One time she's filming a movie in Georgia and basically asked if I want to come along during the filming. And I say, I have nothing else to do, so I may as well. You know, I'll come down and help out and do whatever I can, probably mostly be in the way, but, you know, it'll be some time to kill, and I can do what I do, which is be on the internet and try to find people to kind of join me in this thing.
Right.
And so I went down there. As I got off the plane, I realized that I had left my wallet in the plane. I don't know if you know this, Chris, but they won't let you back onto the plane if you leave something on
it. A few times, yeah.
So desperately trying to get back on, I realized that now I'm in Georgia with no exit strategy because I have no identification. I don't have a passport at this time, and I have no ID. And
were you just in the gate, or were you actually gone from the airport?
I literally just gotten out of the plane.
And they wouldn't go back
and
get it for
you? Wouldn't let me back on. And then the woman says, I'll go look and see, and does a cursory look, of course, comes back. No, there's nothing here. And I kept telling her, just so you know, I am poor. So if you do take the wallet, there is nothing in your future in terms of monetary gain here. to no avail. I get off and I realize that now there's nothing I can do. So I contact, at this point, I'd still not switched over to a California ID. Mm-hmm. I was still an Ohio resident. And so I call the DMV and I find out that it's going to take like 6 weeks sight unseen to get a new ID sent out, because I have to fill out all this paperwork. Otherwise, I'd have to go to a DMV.
Right.
I'd still have to go to a DMV in Atlanta and all this stuff. And I go, well, it looks like I'm just staying here with you for the duration of the filming of this movie. So I will be here every day if you have anything for me to carry or what have you.
Right.
So lo and behold, I had an exceptional amount of time to kill every day, which usually consisted of standing very near the craft service table and waiting for them to put down more things that I could eat, and then sort of doing once around the set, walking back to the craft service table.
Nodding your head wisely.
Yeah, sort of.
Everything looks good here.
Yeah, everything looks good. Yeah. Making a movie over there. That's great.
What movie was it?
It was Halloween 2, directed by Rob Zombie.
Nice. Yeah. Okay.
So and everybody was super nice down there, so I didn't have any problems. It was just that I had nothing to do. So, you know, it was – I could sense that I was more annoying than – I mean, because come on, you just have this 18-year-old, like, punk kid walking around, you know, messing with his swoopy hair and, like, eating all your craft service and giving nothing to the production.
Right.
At the time, you know, I probably didn't have as much awareness on it, but I was like, probably annoying people, so I should make a friend. And the one guy who kind of gravitated towards me was this guy named Patrick Fogarty, who – his job on the set was to film all of the B-roll and behind-the-scenes footage for the DVD release.
Okay.
So he, too, had a great deal of time to kill because in between takes, somebody from Weinstein says, hey, come on in, film this, and we'll kind of set it up, talk to Rob for a minute, come out, and then you stand out there at craft service for a while, too. So we would stand together. And he wore a Detroit Tigers hat often, so I started referring to him as Magnum. And
perfect.
You know, so that was kind of our little thing. And he had a mustache at the time, just basically teasing
each other. Once again, you're 18. You should not know who Magnum P.I. is, but you're an old soul.
Yeah, so. References. I love references.
A lot of references you got.
So we get to talking, and he says that, you know, most of what I do at home is I do a lot of like commercial editing and that kind of thing, but I also have gotten into doing music videos. And of course I say, well, you are in luck, sir, because you happen to have met a man who definitely has a full band and would love to make a music video.
The hottest band in LA
right
now.
Exactly. The hottest band in the world.
So yeah, me.
Yeah, me.
So you're like Lars when he called Brian Slagle and said, can you put my band on Metal Massacre? Do you have a band? No, I'll find one.
Yeah, exactly. So that's sort of I went very high there. Exactly.
That's good. Yeah.
So that was kind of the thing. And so time passes, the movie's over, I go back home. Mm-hmm. Nothing's really come of that conversation. And again, I'm banking on what I've normally banked on, which is that people don't listen to people that are telling them about how great their band is.
Of course.
And so I'm just banking that maybe that guy took it to heart, but for the most part, probably not, and he's moved on to the next thing. I get a call out of the blue one day. Hey, it's Patrick. I have some time. If you can get together a budget, let's make this video. You know, send me a song. And so first reaction is, well, I'll buy some time. I'll send him a song. I send him 3 or 4 songs. We agree that Knives and Pens is the song. And he says, all right, let's do it. Now, what kind of budget can you get? And I said, here's the thing. I do not have a full band, nor do I have any money at all. And we don't have a label. So I'll make you a promise, Patrick Fogarty. If you do this video for me for free and I can somehow acquire a small budget, I promise you that you will be making all of my videos, and that when I'm signed to a big major label, we're going to make a movie together. We're going to do everything together. Mm. And again, I don't understand. To this day, I tease him because I don't understand why he believed the lie of an 18-year-old. But he said, okay, sounds good. Let's do it.
Not so much a lie, though. It was your confidence in yourself.
Sure, but right. Something that isn't true yet yeah. is still, I think, theoretically a lie.
It's a dream.
Right? Yeah, it's a dream. Yeah, it's a lie dream.
Yeah. dream lie.
And so I then get off the phone, and I realize that I have to find a band because we've set this date and I'm going to make this video. And I go to my girlfriend at the time's friend, who is a female drummer. And
who
I
was the girl? She was in Halloween 2.
Her name was Scout.
Scout. I was going to guess Scout.
Yeah. So
Scout Thompson or something?
Taylor Compton. Taylor, that's yeah. it. So I go to her friend and I say, you know, you are a drummer. I know that we don't know each other very well, but I'm making this video, and really what I need you to do is to pretend to be the drummer in my band for the video. Yeah. Sound good? Sounds good. All right. The other thing that I need you to do is to give me some money. I don't know how much you might have, but I promise I'll pay you back the money that you give me. And so she throws in a little bit. She had a job. She was working, I think, at the time. She was working for Vivid Entertainment in the shipping right. room or something. She was taking
stock room.
I think she was a porn delivery person or something like that. She delivered porn goods to the
porn is here.
Yeah, to the local townsfolk.
Right.
And so then I went.
So you got a drummer.
Yeah, I have a drummer now. So I remembered that there was this kid that I played a local show with in Cincinnati named Chris, who he said he was going to move to L.A., and that was kind of a thing we had talked about. And so I found him on MySpace. I said, hey, are you in L.A.? He says, yes, I'm in Riverside. I say, great. Can you pretend to be in my video? It's next week. You know, he doesn't have any money, so whatever. That's fine. You have a guitar. and then I have to round it out because I figure I at the very least have to have a bass player. It's a two-guitar song, but I figure we can kind of fudge that in the video.
Yeah, sure.
So I find this bass player on MySpace. His name's Alan. And he does not look the part at all, but it is the 11th hour, and I have lived with the assumption that I can throw a little black eye makeup on anybody.
Sure.
And
put him in a dress.
Yeah,
whatever.
He's got kind of hair, I guess, like he had some hair, yeah. and you can take the glasses off anybody, you know? Yeah. And so and so he comes down, and then here we go. It's time to make the video. And the whole wearing all white thing, again, came from budgetary reasons of, like, we have nothing. And so mm-hmm. the white psych wall is there. Can't afford to decorate it, so let's just make this a white-themed video. and the night before the video, Alan comes to me crying, and he says that his girlfriend, who he's been dating for 2 months, dog died in San Jose, and he needs to fly there right now to be with her. And I go, Alan, I feel like this could potentially be a mistake that you will later regret.
Yeah. Plus, you're flying. You just told me you had no money.
Yeah. right. Yeah. So, he literally lays the. It was my bass. It was a Nikki Six Thunderbird. You know, of course, the prerequisite. Got to have that.
Got to have it. Right.
And he lays it down, leaves. We never see him. And then the video is being shot in like
I love
six
the
hours.
The symbolic gesture of laying the bass down.
Yeah, like he literally laid it on the floor.
Boom.
I didn't have a case, so it was just sort of on the floor and did that.
So now you're down to three.
Down to three, including myself. And I look through the stock room at it's called Atomic Studios in downtown LA, and they have an exceptional number of all-white mannequins. So I think, instead of having band members, let's just trick them with how many things are going on. So we pile 50 mannequins with no face.
Right.
Mannequins sounds like an Irish bar. Mannequins with no
face. Down to mannequins.
Yeah. And so we put them all there. Of course, they're washed out as soon as the camera turns on.
Right, but it's all white.
Yeah, it's all white. But there's the idea that there's something there. We shoot the video. We shoot
as a three-piece.
Yes. And then the thought is that I wanted to have a storyline. And so I wanted to kind of tell an element of the story of what it's like to have been me growing mm-hmm. up in the area that I grew up in and kind of being outcasted for my interest in music or my visual interest or whatever else. And so we did a casting, which is amazing. If you've ever done a casting with when you are paying no money, there's a guarantee of no money, the people that come in for that are the greatest people of all time. Because
yeah,
these are people that are just trying to do something.
Right.
And so we had a casting for like a child. The idea was that it would be like 12 to 14 kind of alternative looking kid. Most of what came in was 8-year-old girls singing "The Sun Will Come Out Tomorrow," like, "Hi, I'm Dorothy with the William Morris Agency. The Sun Will Come Out." That whole, the Louis C.K. thing, that whole, like, that sort of vibe, that's mostly what came in. And then one kid came in named David who came in and sang, like, every song off of the first three Alice Cooper records just, like, consecutively. And, like, we're like, we didn't ask for that, but at least you know it, thank you. Yeah. And you're our kid. And so he was in the video. We shot him at a couple different locations, stole some locations. We snuck into a school and on the weekend and filmed a bunch of stuff of him in the school. We used a friend's house for his room. We used my bedroom in my girlfriend's bedroom in the apartment that I lived in. did not pay rent towards. And we shot in there, and then we put it up on the internet. And literally within several days, it had 15,000, 20,000, like crazy.
From what?
I have no idea. To this day, people, young bands will ask me, how do you build that trajectory? How do you have that? And to me, the only thing I can associate it with is that we had a strong presence and there was an interest in whatever this material was going to be, because I had done so much used car salesman-ing, if you will, over the years of like, come on, it's going to be great. You can't wait for it.
Yeah.
And then when it happened, it was pretty good. I mean, I look back at it and obviously musically and visually, there's done much better stuff in my career. But I look back at it and say that for the time, I think it was the right thing at the right time. I think that the story in it was something that resonated with particularly the younger set of our audience, and it was the right thing to kind of give us some exposure, and people really loved it. And to this day, people love it. When we play that song live, people go nuts.
What year was that?
That was 2009.
So it's just like, if you're thinking about like the Blair Witch Project, or I think Paranormal Activity, the first one, I think they made it for like $15,000.
Yeah.
And then it goes on to make, $400 million executive produced by Steven Spielberg. So a lot of times it's not about the money, it's about the drive and the message and the theme that you had in that video. Because like we said, $150 million for a video that cost
nothing. End of the day, I think what it was my parents gave me a little bit of whatever kind of like money that I had in college fund or savings. The main thing was that I had they donated some money, and then I had done some acting when I was younger, and I had a little bit of money in what they call a Coogan account,
mm-hmm.
which is money that you can't touch until you're 18. And so I had a little bit of that, and then the money that Sandra, the drummer at the time, gave me, and it was, I think, in all, it was like $1,500 or something.
Did you does Patrick still make your videos?
Yeah, we made Patrick has made every single video except for one.
Mm-hmm.
We made a movie together. We made the Legion of the Black movie, which was in limited release in theaters.
Right,
it was shown internationally. Still in Mexico, it still shows like once a year. Fans get together and have a big like Rocky Horror thing. We've made huge budget videos.
So you kept your word.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
Did Sandra get her money back?
Yes, she did. Yeah,
with interest?
Yeah, exactly. And so while she didn't stay in the band, she kind of had – musically, our interests were never the same from the beginning. Mm-hmm. So it was one of those things where it was like there was a kind of a ticking time bomb of when that was going to end, because she didn't want to kind of play the music
we were
heading into. But, she was a great sport and stayed with us for, I think, like 2 years.
Talk is Jericho.
Sitting here with Andy Bierzak of the Black Veil Brides. So let's talk about your new album. It's your fourth record, and you did it with one of the most amazing legendary producers of all time, at least of our era, Bob Rock. And Bob has not done a metal record probably since Saint Anger, maybe?
Yeah,
in 2003?
The last real hard rock record that he made was the Lost Prophets record, which I think was like 2002, 2003 or something. But that wasn't a hard rock or metal record. It was more of a, kind of emo.
Yeah, it's kind of emo English-type rock type of a thing. But as far as just a full-on hard rock metal record, I mean, that used to be Bob's forte.
Absolutely.
And stepped away from it probably, I don't know if he was burned out or whatever. How did you get in contact with Bob and start making this happen? Was it your idea or was it his?
You know what? I wish that the story of us with Bob Rock was more I wish that there was a story where like we slept outside of his house and begged him or something. But by virtue of the fact that the band had received some form of success and due largely to the record that we made with John Feldman, had we not made that record with John Feldman, had we not
Is that Wretched and Divine?
Yeah, had we not written in the end, I don't think we ever get to Bob Rock. I think that record and that song in particular is what kind of catapulted us to the point where people were starting to take notice of the band. As opposed to being kind of a more niche market band, we kind of reached a little bit more radio play and people were kind of taking note and paying attention. Bob had heard In the End on the radio quite a bit in Hawaii on the rock radio station. And didn't know anything about the band, didn't know what we looked like, didn't know any drama, didn't know that I'm the few guy from the Golden Gods, didn't know any of that stuff.
We'll talk about that.
Yes, just knew that he liked the sound of the band, and most particularly, as he told me, which was really amazing for me because I'm not noted as being an amazing singer. He told me he loved the tone of my voice and the style of my voice, which, again, a very specific sounding singing voice. And so to hear that was kind of a huge thing for me and made me realize even more so that he understood the band on a level before he even listened to it. Because, yes, we have incredible guitar players, and, yes, an incredible drummer, and, yes, incredible rhythm section and all this stuff. And there's personalities, and, you know, my bass player is a rock star, and my rhythm guitar player is a violin virtuoso and all that. But he understood just by listening to the music what is the dynamic of the band and why the things work. And so he contacted my manager through the channels. Like, he got a hold of this person who got a hold of this person who got a hold of Blasco, my manager. And he basically said, hey, I'd like to produce their next record. I was in the process of working on some of my solo stuff that I've done. And I got a call from a manager that just said, hey, Bob Rock wants to produce the next Black Veil record. Is that, you know, is that cool? And I go, of course. And he goes, would you want to have breakfast with him tomorrow? Yes, I would like to have breakfast. So we all got up at, you know, Bob's 7:30 a.m. Let's go have breakfast at Swingers. And we went down to Swingers and in Hollywood, and we had breakfast, and we all agreed on every part of what the record should be. I mean, really agreed about sonically where we wanted to go with it. And from that moment went, okay, this is it. And we got into pre-production right away.
What was Bob's vision for you that he wanted to not change about the band, but what did he say to you when he sat down with you?
He had, by the time he had sat down with us, he had listened down to all of our records and understood kind of the trajectory from the more metalcore style or whatever you want to call it of the first record into a more kind of glam or whatever you want to call it. And the second record, third record's much more kind of epic, kind of bombastic thing. And
proggy,
he understood what, before I even said it, which is that the next record needs to be a much more stripped down rock and roll, hard rock record with the heavy guitars and everything, but much more taking the influences that we love so much, like bands like Metallica and Megadeth, and applying those to the things that I love musically, which is, you know, punk rock music. I love the Misfits, and I love Social Distortion, and I love that kind of bluesy, gang vocally kind of sing-along stuff, and applying those two things to basically what we've always wanted to do, but haven't had the ability to do it. He knew that kind of intrinsically, and so it was just an immediate agreement that we had that that's what the record was going
to
be.
Kind of sounds a little familiar to what he told Metallica after Justice for All to the Black Album. You know, you got to strip it down a bit and make it more of a groove rock record.
Absolutely.
How was it working with him in the studio?
Incredible. I mean, and I was telling you, I mean, every day, like, he's a sweetheart. He's you know, and that's the thing is that I would get these calls from press people who, you know, Metallica biographical writers and people who had written stuff about Bob and all this, and they all wanted to know about the militant, angry Bob who was somebody who, you know, have you seen the dark side and this and that? And I always had to laugh because I said, I can totally understand where if you were a band, and obviously Metallica was not that band because you can see in the year and a half in life and all that, you can see that they worked hard. But I'm sure that there were plenty of bands that he worked with in the late 80s and early 90s, particularly when he was working with Bruce Fairburn as his engineer, who were coming in with the I'm a millionaire, I'm a fat cat kind of thing, and didn't make transcendent records and probably got on his bad side and had to do something where he was a little bit more aggressive to get the work out of them. But when you look at something like Dr. Feelgood or the Black Album or Sonic Temple, those are things where clearly those guys would have worked their asses
off.
Our intention was to do that, not to walk in and say, hey, Bob Rock, let's do a record. Because the thing is, we live in a day and age where in 2015, it's being in a rock band is somewhat like being a rotary telephone salesman or, you know, like a black and white TV salesman.
Interesting. Now explain that statement.
It's to a mass market and a mass media, what we have and what we provide is a service that many look at as a nostalgia product. That movie Rock of Ages, what's the punchline? Rock and roll is the punchline. Yeah. Remember when rock used to be around? That's how people see it in a large way.
Yeah.
It's for better or for worse, it is the way it is. We get to have an opportunity within our fan base and the people who do listen to us and as the band grows to hopefully turn people into loving rock and roll music and enjoying the environment and the vibe and everything. And there's so many bands, young bands that have come out that are also doing that, bands like Asking Alexandria and many others that have that vibe going on. Avenged Sevenfold is a great example of that band who really now is on top of the world and started out with the same kind of beginnings. It's possible to transcend that and to be in the mass market public appeal. But when you look at rock and roll, we sort of only have, and I love Dave Grohl and the Foo Fighters, but we get like one guy. We have Dave Grohl.
He's our
representative at all award shows, at all things. They'll trot out the rock guy, and it happens to be a really badass, cool guy. But it's sad that it's only one person that we ever get.
I was driving down Sunset the other day, and it was an old billboard for a Memorial Day, November 11th or whatever. I'm from Canada. I don't know whenever Memorial Day is in the States.
I'm from the United States, and I don't remember when Memorial Day is.
November something or other. And it was the big billboard. It was Kanye West, and it was, you know, Beyonce, and it was, you know, all these bands. And then in the middle, it was Metallica. They were the token rock guys.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and so you either get Grohl and the Foo Fighters, or you get Metallica, and that's it. So.
And there's something to be said, because those are two exceptional artists.
Beyond mainstream, yeah.
Yeah, and there's a reason why they're successful. I'm not one of those guys who goes, oh, boo. You know,
no, of course.
I understand the success. I just think that it's harder to get to that point now because it's not, there's not so much culture, or our culture doesn't put the onus on rock and roll the way that it does hip hop or other genres, because hip hop, for better or for worse, has an aesthetic, it has a culture, it has poetry, it has a vibe, it has art. Those are all things that rock and roll had and still has when you look at like where we exist in the Warped Tour and those kind of things. But the mainstream culture doesn't see it that way. The mainstream culture sees rock and roll as Mumford and Sons and the least vibey thing. What is the least vibey thing? Meanwhile, the hip-hop world and the pop world jock all the aesthetic values of rock and roll music.
And country.
Yeah, they're all wearing leather jackets and they're all wearing Misfit shirts and whatever else. But it's not because of rock and roll being important, it's because they're taking their cherry picking.
Yes, the cliche.
So to be in a rock and roll band in this day and age, it's harder to kind of transcend that. So to get back to what I was saying, it's very important that you try to find a way to, if you're not going to succeed on a multi-global amazing way or whatever, to have something that is important that can hopefully catapult your career to the next step and to be moving incrementally towards something that is a mass success.
Right. And Bob and his – did he help you with the songwriting as well, or the arrangements?
Bob was around from day one. He's not so much a songwriter as he – I would say, he's much more of a – he's an orchestrator. Mm-hmm. He will sit there for 4 hours and not say anything, and then he'll say one thing that changes the entire scope, and it's the most right thing you've ever heard. And so we – basically his whole process was he wanted to do the same process that he went through with the Black Album, which is extensive pre-production – that we did what he referred to as homework, which is to always, always, always be writing and to be jamming together in the room. And maybe a song will work out, maybe it won't, maybe we'll get something great, maybe we'll scrap it. But to only have the number of songs that we're going to record and to have them perfect and to be working constantly. So every single day we were in a rehearsal space in North Hollywood working and working and working until we had that.
Honing. Yeah. Drum sounds, all that sort of stuff?
Everything,
He's notorious for his drum sound.
Well, he asked CeCe, my drummer, what sound he want or what kind of tone he would want. And CeCe was just like, the Black Album, that works.
Which is funny because almost every album has that sound anyways, because you just sample Lars's kick and snare from that onto everything.
The death kick.
Yeah, and the kick snare.
But we actually didn't – we took a great deal of time to build the drum sound. And we recorded – the other thing was that he wanted to do – he didn't want to put it in one studio and have it all be one value. Mm-hmm. So to get the perfect drum sound, we sampled rooms all around LA and found the room that had the best drum tone. So we recorded at a place called Steakhouse, just the drums themselves, and all kinds of different methods with mics, all the doors open, all the mics everywhere. And like, it was a very interesting process. We had a guy named Mike Fasano come in, and he was our drum tech on the record. And he brought in – we had what they call Big Red, which is the snare that they used.
Ex-Warrant drummer.
Yeah. They used the –
Big Red.
Big Red was the snare on Use Your Illusion and so many other things.
Oh, wow.
And so we wanted that snare sound. We wanted the what they call the Pat Boone, Debbie Boone, the dun, 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 which if you listen on Use Your Illusion, is every single fill.
Wow.
Which apparently – Sorum says that Axl required that fill is on every single song. But if you listen to Yesterday – days or anything, you're gonna hear dun 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 dun. So
no
we
kidding.
Had there's one song where I was like, I don't care if it's cheesy, I want that fill in the
it.
Song.
Yeah, gotta have
and
it.
So he's like, well, I have the snare if you want to use it. I was like, put it on every song, just that snare, always.
So
it was like a lot of that kind of stuff. The guitars were all recorded at my guitar player's house. He's got his own home studio. And my lead guitar player is an exceptional engineer. At first, we suggested that he do the guitars, and Bob was a little wary. And he's like, all right, well, I'll come over every day, and I'll do it with you. And after one day of doing it, Bob's like, that's all right. Just send them to me when you got them, and they're perfect. And they went through – I mean, before this happened, before the guitars were actually recorded, this was weeks and weeks of tone building. I mean, I'm talking – so more amps than you've ever seen and more combinations of tones than you've ever seen to get the perfect tone. And I love the tone that we have on so many of the songs on the record. Vocally, wanted to record it, wanted to go up to where they used to have Little Mountain in where they recorded the Black Album up in Vancouver.
So many classic records.
That doesn't exist anymore, but the board still exists. And so they moved the board to a studio in Gastown in Vancouver.
And let's just explain that to the people that don't know. When you're recording a record, the studio is important, but it's the soundboard. That's what Dave Grohl did his whole documentary on, this soundboard, which is basically the whole lifeblood of the tone.
And this board is the same board as the studio.
Gotcha. So it was taken over there. So it's basically the same studio. It's basically Little Mountain with a different name.
Yeah. And it's the same make and model of the Sound City board.
Okay.
Like they only made so many
of those. Oh, the same board. Yeah, I gotcha. Gotcha.
And so that is in Gastown at the studio. And so we did all the vocals up there, and we did all the additional instrumentation up there, strings, all that kind of stuff. And that is when we had the backup singers come in. We had two guys who, Mark and Mike I can't remember the other gentleman's name. It's going to kill
me.
I feel so bad. But they came in, and they were gentlemen who had sang. Bob had actually found them. They were commercial jingle singers in the, I guess, in the early 80s. And they brought them in to do some of the, I think it was Loverboy or something.
Oh, okay.
And they are the sound of that 80s gang vocal sound. Like those two guys stack and stack and stack. And they are the whoa, yeah.
I'm thinking of it was, whoa, loving every minute. Whoa.
Yeah.
Whoa,
whoa. That's them. And Dr. Feelgood, everything.
Gotcha.
Every record that Bob ever made with that big gang vocal sound, from Bon Jovi to everything, is those guys. And they came in and they sang all the gang vocals with us. We had huge gangs that they sang the leads of the gangs, and we stacked all of them. We had a guy named Mark Webster come in, who was a former Deep Purple piano player. He played all the piano on the record. It was just a really cool vibe. I mean, and then we wound up mixing the record at the former A&M studios in what is now Henson, which is also where they mixed the Black Album.
So. All right. So you had all that stuff. You got to meet Paul Stanley when you were there.
Paul Stanley came in. So many people came in, but Paul came in to be fair, to meet Bob or to talk to Bob. You know, they had met before, but to talk to Bob, I happened to have been there in the room at the time, and he was nice. You know, he knows about the band, and I told you we got that little joke in the,
what
you
was
know,
the joke?
I don't, I didn't recognize you without your makeup on. And I was like, oh, you Paul Stanley, you've been waiting all day to say that. Once you heard that we were in the room next door, I know you had that joke on your mind. He said it first thing too. Like, he didn't waste any time. Hey, I'm Andy from Blackfield Brides. Hey, didn't recognize you without your makeup on. Oh, singer
from Paul.
You got me, Paul. But no, he was a sweetheart. He's really nice. And again, the kind of thing where meeting somebody who's been such an idol to me, and you and I have that mutual love.
Well, yeah,
love,
and we'll talk about that in a bit. It's funny how we became friends through Kiss. But a couple things that you mentioned. First of all was, I want you to tell me, I mean, this record came out. It's been a big hit. You're doing lots of touring. The Black Mass Tour starts tomorrow with Memphis Mayfire and Ghost Town. We'll give all the dates out later on in the show. But you're a very high energy lead singer, and it's led to a couple of injuries that you've had over the years.
I have sustained some injuries.
You even sent me an article. It was like Andy Bierzak's top five injuries on stage or something along those lines.
Yeah, on stage. I had a top five on stage injuries list.
Was that in Metal Hammer or something?
Yes, I think it was a Revolver.
What were some of the top ones?
Let's see. Let's review. 2011 was a difficult year for me on stage. So I would say that the most notable one that everybody talks about was the destroying of my ribs on stage. We were playing a record release show for our second record, and we had been kind of followed all day by these video cameras, and it was kind of this thing that was going to go out on Fuse or one of these places. I can't remember. I think maybe Music Choice. One of those kind of like...
Yeah, like
music
Access
station.
TV,
yeah, whatever. One of the, I can't remember, but they had been following us all day. We did a signing out in like Encino or something at the mall, and then they followed us from there. And we had been signing and working, did two signings that day from like 10 a.m. Then we were going to play the show in the middle of the Hollywood and Highland Mall. Now, anybody who's ever been to the Hollywood and Highland Mall knows that it's not so much a mall as it is a kind of an enclosed area with tiers that go up on either side and nothing in the middle except for kind of like, you know, a fountain and that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
but there's a big courtyard area, and then there's tiers that go up. There's restaurants, there's stores, you know, there's a Hollister, there's a Hot Topic, there's a whatever. And then it leads up into these big statues of elephants. And so... they had kind of built a makeshift stage for us. It was awesome. You know, we were playing the show. It was the third song in. It's packed out. The whole Hollywood Highland Mall spilling out onto Hollywood Boulevard, full of people, stoked to see us. I'm really stoked. I'm also out of my mind, like crazy tired, and I've just been working all day, and I'm like, I gotta do something impactful right now. I gotta show these TV cameras something awesome. And so I go, I'm gonna climb up to those elephants, which, again, I'd like to review that there is an exceptional amount of space between the ground and those damn elephants. It, right. For the listener, if you'd like to Google search an image of the Hollywood Highland Mall, you can see that they overlook everything. I mean, right. You can see them from the skyline. So impossible, because I'm not Spider-Man. I am a 6'2" lanky guy wearing cowboy boots and spandex at the time. Right. And so I decide that I'm going to climb up there. I get maybe one or two rungs up on these marble pillars and realize very quickly that I am not able to do this, what I'm trying to do. I'm wearing cowboy boots with no traction on marble pillars, and I have no exit strategy because I am now up behind the audience. Now, for example, when you see an arena show, half of the crowd is sort of cut off, and then there's those seats behind.
Right.
Where if you're in those behind seats, a singer could not possibly jump from the behind area back into the audience to yeah. brace his fall. So consider that to be the same basic principle here. I'm behind the crowd. There is no way for me to jump into the audience. Now, normally when you climb up to a high point at a show, you know, somebody climbs up on a speaker stack, you either have a way back down.
Yeah.
You have a way back down, you jump down back onto the stage, or you jump into the crowd to brace your fall.
Right.
I am now so far from any of those options that I have no way to go. I just maybe just spend the rest of the show up here.
Right.
And that's option one. Option two is to, for some reason, and I chose option two, sit down gracefully on Indian style on a marble pillar, then outstretch my legs, then tried to rocket myself using my superior upper body strength, superior there should be noted as a joke, down onto the stage, which is impossible from science.
Aerodynamically, it just can't be
not possible. And so I fall sadly like a ragdoll, a glam rock ragdoll, falling down, and I fall about 15 feet, hit my ribs on this marble pillar.
And it goes...
Yes, yeah, smacked right away. Crack all my ribs. Destroy. 9, 10, 11 are broken. The 11th rib is just shrapnel bone. Like, not, it just cracks into a billion pieces. I now check out, and someone that I don't know goes back on stage that people tell me was me. I've watched video. I don't know that guy.
Yeah.
And finished the show somehow. But
wow.
But by calling out songs that we had A, never played, or B, had not played in years.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that some sort of lizard brain kicked in where I'm just like, autopilot, whatever. Here's a song from our first record.
They ain't talking about love.
Yeah, there's some great video of me saying song names that we have never rehearsed and the band going like, I guess we should.
Did they see you fall?
No, no one knew what happened because it's behind the stage. So they just think I'm crazy and like I've been gone for – they kept playing during the time that I was gone because they thought that I was in the crowd.
Oh.
Because there was no – it was a makeshift stage, so the monitor system was poor. At the time, we weren't on in-ears, so they couldn't, they just assumed that they couldn't hear me. So they're playing and then they realize that the song is over and it's just silence. So the song's over, people cheer, silence, and then I hobble back on. What's up, everybody? Let's keep going. So I then am – the show is over. I'm taken off the stage. The only people that rush to my side immediately, or not the only people, but the people who do immediately rush to my side are my friends, Matt and my friend Jeffrey. Jeffrey is Jeffree Star. Some people might know. It's kind of a famous androgynous character.
Okay.
I wouldn't say transvestite because he's a male, but he, you know, kind of dresses in female clothes and is great makeup. Wonderful guy, but a very interesting looking character.
Hot, yeah.
Considering the fact that I am also wearing head-to-toe makeup and black paint all over my body and have crazy hair. And now I am being taken to the hospital with my only friend that somehow made it with me into that, into triage, is my friend Jeffrey. So now Jeffrey, who is like an 8-foot-tall man in heels and full makeup, is pushing around a wheelchair of me, who I appear to be some sort of like Tim Burton, like drunken rough sketch.
Yeah.
Like something where like Tim Burton was wasted. It was like, I'll make up a character. Like that's sort of what I appear to be, with broken ribs, screaming bloody murder, and paint all over me. And then I go into triage, and they can't. Of course, they do 100 drug tests on me because they assume
he must be wasted.
Yeah. And so then my girlfriend, my ex-girlfriend at the time, or I don't remember. We were kind of on and off. Same girl from before comes in, and my mom is there. And then my cousin comes, and we all spend a week in a rehabilitation treatment facility where, and it's the funniest circumstance. It was me, Jeffree Star, my mom, my ex-girlfriend, and my cousin all in this like room where I'm trying to learn to walk every day. And disgustingly, wow. For you listeners at home, that meant that I had to pass the pieces of bone through me. Ooh. Because I had these shrapnel bits of bone. So that involved enemas. So nice. You haven't lived until your ex-girlfriend is giving you an enema.
It's a long way to the top if you want to rock and roll, yeah. Is what we're saying. And yeah. Now, you're mentioning, too, about, like, you know, you had so many fans and people were just going nuts in the mall and everywhere you go. But Black Veil Brides also very a polarizing band, especially when you first started, you know, when you first – because you guys are such good – I mean, you're a doll. You're a gorgeous guy.
Thank you so much.
And you mentioned –
likewise.
You mentioned earlier about the gold –
I hope this is the way the interview would go when I came
yeah,
here.
There you go. We talked about packing at first.
Now let's get into the important thing. Good-looking dudes.
Real good-looking dudes. And that, as a result, has led some people to not like you just because of the way you look, which is basically life and the world, and especially in rock and roll. And the Golden Gods you mentioned, which I host, and this is where I got super respect for you. I was watching you because you guys won the People's Choice Award, whatever they called it, Fans Choice Award, and some guys in the crowd were booing you. And I know these people, not personally, but in Golden Gods, there was always the loud mouse that would just be yelling. Sure. And I would just tell me to shut up. And basically, you came up to accept your award and continue.
So it was the song of the year.
That's what
which
it was.
The song was In the End, right. Which is the song that we wrote, and the lyrical content I wrote about the death of my grandfather, who was very close to me. And then later, I had found out that he used almost word for word those same words in his eulogy for his own father when he died. So I have this really strong connection to this song. I don't know if you would call it spiritual or whatever. I have a very strong connection to the song. Means a lot to me. Mm-hmm. I had, when I found out that we had won this, I had prepared, not necessarily prepared a speech, but I had something that I wanted to say about the death of my grandfather
how much
and how
it
important
means
it was.
To you,
yeah,
right.
Exactly. And how I appreciate our fans specifically for voting for this because it meant a lot to me. And I told my parents that I was going to do this and whatever else. And as things tend to go with award shows, the time frames are kind of skewed and you're told to go up there a little too early or a little too late. We were put up a little too early. So I think Hailstorm or somebody was accepting something on the stage. And so that put us just standing next to the crowd and in visual, like in plain sight of people who are incredibly mad that Metallica is not playing it. And I should clarify something to the listener because I often get people come up and say, like, you flipped off Lemmy. Lemmy was not in the room.
Yeah, yeah. Chances are you didn't flip off Lemmy.
The artists at the Golden Gods are up in a separate area from the crowd. And so the crowd are people that are ostensibly there to see whoever the headliner is, really.
Yeah.
The live bands, whether it's Metallica, Guns N' Roses, whoever. And I understand that, but anybody that I haven't played before Metallica at Download, I know that it's not the most fun to play before Metallica. So me, now, a guy that they already don't like just talking about some shit, not even playing songs, is so much more annoying to them because I'm in front of Metallica. So I get that. But what I don't get is the barrage of abuse that is happening while we're just trying to fucking wait to go up there to receive a thing that we didn't – it's not like we walked up there and said, hey, everybody, I know you're trying to watch Metallica. But I'm going to talk for a while right now.
You won an
award.
Unwarranted.
I'm just going to talk and you're going to indulge me. No, we were voted for an award by our fans, which, again, the point that I would have liked to have made a little bit more clear had I not turned into, like, crazy heel, was that they should have voted for someone if they were interested in someone else
winning.
Yes. But I think more than anything, the anger came from the fact that it was, A, a band that they maybe didn't like, and then, B, we were just taking the time up that they needed to be doing something else or seeing something else. I don't think that they necessarily cared who won, because I don't think that anybody was heartbroken that Metalocalypse didn't win Song of the Year that year. So we go up there, and they're already throwing stuff. We're already – like, my dam is burst at this point. I'm already, like, livid. And in the kind of livid where, like, you are way too mad at a – like, when, like, something happens. Like, say, like, you go to kill a bug and you miss it, and then you get super mad at that bug because, like – and you're like, I have to kill it now. That is sort of the level of mad that is unwarranted in some capacity. But also, I was angry that they're being mean. But I was, like, ridiculously mad because I had that I wanted to say, and now you're yelling at me. And I, you know, like, so it escalated very quickly. And then while I was up there, and not unlike what Paul said, sometimes it's fun to just say something. Yeah. And so I was like, I'm already talking. I should just keep this going. Mm-hmm. I should say the thing.
Some people are booing.
Yeah. I'm like, I don't care. I'll keep saying the thing that I want to say right now because you now have to listen.
Yeah.
And they might kick me off the stage. I don't know what's going to happen. At this point, no one's ever done this at the Golden Gods before. So I legitimately just wanted to make it known that A, I was upset that they were doing that, and B, that it was unnecessary to be doing that, and C, that I was allowed to kind of say what I wanted because I had won an award. If you're not going to let me say the thing that I wanted to say initially, I'm going to give you back what you're giving me. And I think that, though it isn't my most proud moment, and I don't hang my hat on, wow, I'm the f*** you guy from the Golden Gods, like, yeah, I do, I am not, I don't have regret about it in the sense that I always advocate for people to stand up for themselves and not let people give them. I think it's important that if you're out in your day-to-day life and somebody walks by you and says, hey, stupid shirt or whatever, you ask them, what? Why did you say that? Mm-hmm. People should atone for the things that they think are so flippant and whatever.
Especially in this day and age when you can just send a tweet or say something on Facebook and you never have to face the music for what you've said. There's no accountability.
Certainly.
This was the case when there was, because you were right there in their face and you turned heel on it. It was great. I loved it.
Right. And that's kind of the thing is that, again, it's we laugh about it now and I make the joke that, you know, anywhere I go, like we played Rock on the Range the next week, and people were flipping me off as a sign of adoration. Like, hey, it's the f- you guy. Look.
I remember that you even said, I think there was even, it might just be my own mind, because I was watching, go, I love this guy now. I think you might have said, shut up, fat boy. There might have been one of those in there, too.
I think, of all of it, that's the number one thing that I regret is bringing in someone's physical appearance, because that kind of goes against.
Well,
but it was tough when someone's just making fun of me for the way that I look. I'm like, bro, come on. You have cheese on your shirt right now. Like,
did you get – I mean, we've never really talked about this either, but I've seen a couple things. For example, when Sting came back, you wore a Sting shirt. You're a wrestling fan.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially when I was younger, I was very much into wrestling because of the vibe and the pageantry and the
show business aspect.
Yeah, it was everything that I loved about – rock bands and Kiss especially, and like it was really, for me it was a great thing. I loved both WCW and at the time WWF. I loved the vibe that happened there. I still will watch WWE from time to time. You know, and I told you that. And we've had a great relationship with them using a lot of our songs. And,
that's right.
Right now, Heart of Fire is the song for the 2K15 game, and like it's really wonderful.
As a matter of fact, there was one pay per view where there was two songs. One was
both
a
of us.
File,
yeah,
one
yeah.
was a Fozzy song. Yeah. I remember that. It was great. Last thing we're talking about Kiss. I mean, you and I have become really good friends. Basically because of Kiss. I think maybe I saw a picture of you on Instagram. We had exchanged numbers like, hey, you like Kiss? You're like, yeah, you like Kiss? And suddenly it's like, no, we don't just like Kiss. We love
Absolutely.
Kiss. And, it's, and non-makeup Kiss too, which
Certainly.
Paul does not like from having him on this show.
As sure.
you heard. Not that he doesn't like it, but he doesn't like it the way we do. What is it about the non-makeup era that you love in comparison to the makeup era?
You know what it is? I think in some ways it was obviously an association of the time period when I first got into the band.
Mm-hmm.
My first Kiss record was Revenge.
Mm-hmm.
And so there wasn't the makeup was a nostalgic
right.
thing, or it was, you know, going to be in the not too distant future. But at the time when I first got into the band, it wasn't a thing.
Mm-hmm.
I remember seeing, you know, my dad's old trading cards of the band, and I dug the look. Particularly, I liked the Gene look. I thought that was really awesome. He was kind of this demon, and I'd paint my face like that every day.
Yeah.
And particularly like, I loved the Hotter Than Hell era, like the simplistic outfits. I thought that was so badass and really played well with the other kind of interests that I had, particularly like wrestling and stuff. Like it had all that vibe. But the music for me with Revenge was like the first rock record that, like, I don't know, it hit to me. It just like that aha moment where you're like, this is what I love.
It's my favorite Kiss album.
This is the thing for me. I don't know, you know, and so from there, the trajectory of my interest just went like, okay, well, what's the one before that? And what's the one before that? And we talked about on Christmas Day, all the VHS tapes and all that stuff took place during the non-makeup era. So my immediate interest was in the band from there. And I kind of worked backwards. And then when the reunion tour happened, obviously the makeup came back. But I was one going, oh.
Me like, too.
I was one going, oh, I wish – I loved the whole Bruce Kulick and Eric Singer thing. Like, why can't – why couldn't – if you're going to do the makeup, why can't they just be in the makeup?
It's especially when Paul did the show, I said to him, like, because he was talking about how Ace and Peter weren't very – as good and the shows were very loose. And I was like, but you had such a tight band
sure.
with Eric and Bruce. And he's like, well, we gained something. We lost something from the reunion. Because
sure.
I was the same. I was like, oh, like Revenge and then Carnival was Souls, and they were just getting back to being this kick-ass rock and roll band,
sure.
and then they went, you know, back to the past, which I understand.
However, with the reunion tour, I think that because I had such a love for the aesthetic of the original band, and then when I got to see them as a little kid on the reunion tour and that kind of stuff, I had a much deeper adoration at that point for that, and I was stoked that they had the makeup back on. I was the kid who, when I went to go see Generation Swine Tour with Motley Crue on the program, I drew little eye black on Nikki's picture because I wanted that stuff. I liked that aesthetic. Yeah. I wanted it back. Even if it was just something as small as that. So I love that the style was back. And I have a deep love, particularly, like, you know, I could take or leave Peter, nothing against him. I don't know him as a person, but his style, I was always much more of an Eric Carr fan of the makeup era. But I love Ace. I love particularly, like, the stuff when he was at his best. When I went to see the reunion tour, or sorry, when I went to see the farewell tour, that was not him at his best. Went to see him the other night in New York, and I had a blast. You know, he sounded great.
He was good.
He was good. You know, he's not a consistent guitar player, and you know, and in my band and what I play, the music I play, it's very consistent.
Right.
Kind of
everything has to be perfect,
intricate stuff. And so I dig the vibe of kind of the loose, jangly. You know, you can hear his rings hitting the strings and that kind of thing. So I love Ace Frehley. But yeah, I was just such a fan of that era of the band, and more importantly, I and I've told you this, I put so much importance on the education that Kiss gave me, Gene and Paul in particular. I credit them for my interview skills, whatever I have in my life in terms of ability to communicate publicly or to be able to answer questions well. The things that I sometimes get credit for or praise for, I often will credit them because they were the ones that really initially for me as a young kid, I had so much interest in hearing them speak, particularly Paul. I just thought he was the coolest, most intelligent dude, and I loved his the way that he would use words to explain something that maybe didn't need it. You know, you didn't need to have such crazy verbiage going on in a sentence about a rock band, but he made it seem so important, and you were pulled into
and
that
Kiss
world.
Kiss was always about self-empowerment, too, about believing in yourself and following your dreams. And, you know, like Paul said, don't listen to people who are negative. And actually, it's funny because you and I have both done Three Sides of the Coin, the Kiss podcast, and talked about that extensively. And because I've done that podcast, I've had Kiss Magazine and some other Kiss one in Brazil call me because they want to talk about how did Paul Stanley influence your life?
Yeah.
And it was basically just by standing up for what you believe in. You know, if someone's booing you, you tell them to F off.
Absolutely.
You know, if someone tells you you can't do something, you do it. If someone says, I'll make you a music video, I got a band.
Absolutely. Well, look at that video of Paul yelling at the guy with the laser pointer.
Oh,
everybody
yeah.
makes fun of it, but you think about we've all been there. You've been there.
Absolutely.
Where you're on stage and you're going, something is so annoying and you can't believe that somebody would want to ruin the show experience for somebody else that you have to call them out. I have a great amount of respect for people that do that. And so for me, my influence came from that stuff. All the reasons, maybe not – I was not as heavily influenced in terms of songwriting by Kiss as much as the original reason why I got into rock music, and the reason that I love rock music so much is 100% because of Kiss.
What's your favorite Kiss record?
Revenge, I would have to say, just because of, again, the nostalgia factor. And it is a great record, but every time I put it on, it really transports me.
It takes
me.
You back to that time, right? What's your favorite songs to play live now?
My favorite songs to play live?
Yeah.
Or my favorite Kiss songs?
No, yeah. What are your favorite? Yeah, well, you guys played Unholy.
Yeah, we did Unholy.
What Black Veil Bride songs do you
We like? Also did, and I'll tell you this, nobody really knows about this, we toyed with Bob. We demoed out an entire I Was Made for Loving You, Don Black Veil Bride style that exists somewhere in the world that maybe we'll record for real one day. But it was during one of the days when we were in pre-production and we kind of hit a wall and we're like, let's just do something fun for a couple hours.
Yeah.
And so we literally, you know, with mics in the middle of, you know, the room, old school style, track this whole demo of us doing this kind of heavy metal style I Was Made for Loving You. So maybe that'll see
you
the
just
light
never, That's what we did with SOS and it made it on the record.
I heard about that.
You
yeah.
just never know. It's funny because the Unholy video, I'm in it. Because
we're
at Download and we walk past each other, and there's actually a picture of us walking past each other, and I think they say, hey man, and then it's like, and then now we're like buds.
Yeah, we exchanged something there. Yeah, though. We don't know what it is. You zoomed in on the photo.
Yeah, some kind of pill or something.
Yeah, I don't know. Something you gave me right before I went on stage.
Yeah, some kind of spy films or something. For Black Veil though, when you play your shows now and you're getting ready for the Black Mass tour starts tomorrow, what tunes do you still really love to play, and what tunes are the fans like to hear?
Obviously, I love to play new songs like anybody. You have that
Faithless.
Vibe of like, hey, it's a new thing. Yeah, I love to play
That's
Faithless.
A great song.
Love to play Heart of Fire. But, you know, there's certain songs that in our career I've always been excited about playing. I love Rebel Love Song live. I love Knives and Pens live because I love the vibe that people get from it. Wretched and Divine's a great song. But to me, the number one song in terms of the the electricity in the room is always in the end, just mm-hmm. because that song, I mean, as soon as the first, like, the drum hits, it's something where, as a kid, you look up to your favorite bands and you hear them describe that moment when they play their hit or their song that was their big song. And I'm not saying that our song's a hit or whatever. I'm just saying
it was a hit.
Thank you. That, you know, does well for them.
Yeah.
That moment I get to experience every night, and that's a really cool thing. Regardless of whether it's the end of the show and we're tired or whatever, when that song starts and, you know, we have confetti and there's all the video and everything, like, it's a big moment. So that's really cool.
It's a rock and roll moment. Andy,
absolutely.
Thanks for coming, man. It's been great.
We've been
working on this for a while.
Finally.
And
awesome. I'm so sad it's over now.
I know.
Let's go on for another hour.
We'll do another episode. Yeah. We'll do a lot of parts.
All
thanks,
right.
dude. Thanks to Andy Biersack from Blackville Brides. Great guy, great friend. Their new self-titled record is out now. It's produced by the legendary Bob Rock, and he's going to be a guest on this show. I tracked him down. You can catch the Blackville Brides on the Black Mass Tour starting tomorrow in Richmond, Virginia, and go check out the Blackville Brides self-titled record. Get that on Amazon. Hearts of Fire is great. Faithless is great. Andy's voice sounds better than ever. This is one of the biggest, upcoming, coolest bands of the new era, and I suggest you go check them out. I also suggest that you go check out Robert Trujillo's documentary about the amazing Jaco Pastorius. And you need to do that because tomorrow, Thursday, February 5th, is the last day to help Robert get what he needs from Pledge Music to get this movie done. It's pledgemusic.com/projects/Jaco, the film. J-A-C-O is Jaco. They got some very cool giveaways depending on your donation level. You can donate and get a 30-minute Skype call with Robert Trujillo. Talk to him about anything you want. The new Metallica record, Infectious Grooves, if you want to. Infectious Grooves is in the house. Or you can still donate and get an in-person bass lesson with Robert. He's one of the greatest bass players of all time at the Henson Studios in Hollywood. They got some amazing Jaco guitar straps. You can pre-order the DVD. That's what I did. It's signed by Robert. They're trying to get the film finished in time and released this April for Record Store Day. They're almost there. They're 97% of the way there. Let's help take it over the top. Go to pledgemusic.com/projects/Jaco the film and help Robert get this movie made. All right. Got a couple days left. You know I'm going to be in Jacksonville on Saturday for WWE Jacksonville. You know I'm going to be in Canton, Ohio on Sunday for WWE Canton. And before both of those shows, I will be doing Fozzie in stores at FYE for Do You Want to Start a War signings. Saturday, February 7th, before the Jacksonville show at 4 p.m., I will be at the FYE Orange Park Mall, Orange Park, Florida. You just go call down there, check it out or whatever it is. And also on February 8th at 4 p.m., I will be in Akron, Ohio at the Chapel Hill Shopping Center, FYE. So if you live in those areas, Akron or Jacksonville, and you want to come by and say hi to me and pick up a copy of Do You Want to Start a War, that's where I'm going to be. So come say hi, please. I guarantee you're going to have a fun time. And if you don't, I will cry. And I'll also cry if you live in the UK and don't come to the Cinderblock Party World Tour 2015. That starts March 4th in Belfast, Ireland. 5th, Cork, 6th, Dublin, 7th, Nottingham, 8th, Wolverhampton, 9th, Manchester, 10th, Glasgow, 11th, London, 12th, Bristol, 13th, Exeter, 14th, Southampton, 15th, Brighton, 17th, Paris, 18th, Pratteln, Switzerland, 19th, Munich, Germany, 20th, Mannheim, 21st, Bochum, Germany. All information, FozzyRock.com. All gig info and VIP packages. We have the best VIP packages you could ever get. You want to come hang out with Fozzy, come out to our shows, see a sound check, take a picture with the band, shoot the breeze, see what's up. You can do that with us. All right. That's about all. Once again, Amazon links. Keep on shopping through those links. I appreciate it. You know I do. You go to podcast1.com. Click on the Keep Our Podcast free banner at the top of the page. Click on Talk is Jericho. See all those Amazon links if you live in the States, or if you live in Canada, or live in the UK. You know what you got to do. You help shop on that. You help my show. No extra fees or hidden charges for you. Just getting your shopping done. Help me out in the process. All right. Thank you so much. Thanks to Andy Biersack. Thanks to you guys for being here. That's it. Another fine, fun-filled edition of Talk is Jericho. And we'll see you on Friday. But in the meantime, in the between time, that is it. A bigger, yeah, boy. And on Friday, this guy's a really requested guest as well, and very, very interesting. Actually, bone-chilling. You guys know I like having paranormal experts on this show, whether it be ghost hunters, UFO hunters, lake monster hunters, Bigfoot hunters. I got another ghost hunter coming up, and he's probably the biggest ghost hunter in the world today. Zach Baggins from Travel Channel's Ghost Adventures show is going to be here on Friday. And you better listen to this one during the day when the lights are on. Listen to it with a friend because you're going to be freaked out. There is ghosts. There is being attacked by ghosts, haunted houses, demonic possessions. Zach was possessed by a demon. He's going to tell us all about that. This is real stuff. So get ready to be scared and get ready to have a great day. I'll see you very soon. Thank you, guys. Yeah, boy.
You can download new episodes of Talk is Jericho every Wednesday and Friday at podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.